This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever.
He didn't stay long at the Indianapolis 500, but by the time he left, he had become a legend. Growing up poor, he built a racing career out of the dirt at the local tracks in California. He had more desire than natural talent and drove himself to victories, both literally and figuratively. By the time he got to Indianapolis, he had made himself one of the best and proved it immediately. He was co-rookie of the year in 1961, then the pole sitter and a record setter in 1962, and then the pole sitter and winner in his third race in 1963. He never won again, but he ran first or second in all seven of his races. And he might be best remembered for the one he dominated in the most innovative car ever to run in the 500, but lost because a $6 part failed with 3.5 laps to go. He retired from the 500 when he was just 34 years old, with mind and body intact. But he went on to build a wildly successful business career that's still going strong. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with a racing legend, Parnelli Jones. Well, today on One-on-One, we are privileged to be with one of the most distinctive, historic, successful, and respected drivers in the history of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the winner of the 1963 race, Parnelli Jones. And Parnelli, I'd like to start, you know, with the name. You've got a distinctive name, and I know the story of how you got the nickname Parnelli, but Rufus Parnell Jones is your real name. Were you named after someone?
Yeah, actually, I was born in Texarkana, Arkansas, and my mother worked for a judge, and his name was Rufus Parnell. She thought he was the more successful person that she knew, and so she named me after him.
Okay. And I know you moved from Arkansas to Torrance, California. At what age was that?
Well, actually, my parents moved to a place called Fallbrook when I was about a year and a half old, and I lived there until I was about seven, and which time they moved to the Torrance where I was raised and still live.
Okay. What did your father do?
Well, when he first came to California, he worked in the avocado groves in Fallbrook, and then later he was a crane operator in a factory here in the Torrance area.
So a laborer, basically.
Yeah.
Okay, and obviously you grew up without a lot of money. I mean, you certainly didn't grow up in wealth or anything like that, and I'm sure that had some influence on your later success in business. But what sparked your interest in racing then at the beginning?
Well, actually, when I turned 16, I sold my horse and bought a hot rod, and I used to have to work in a garage after school to keep the thing running because it used to jump time and everything else, so I learned to work on it. And because I was working in a garage, my cousin took his wife's old car and made a jalopy out of it, and being as I was working in the garage, he thought I ought to help him, and which I did, and he used to let me warm it up, and of course that started the whole thing. He didn't do very well with it, and he ran a few races and blew the engine up, and it was set in his backyard, and my buddy and I went over and bought it for $25, and we were going to went and got a junkyard engine and put in it, and we were going to take turns driving it, and of course he never got much of a chance, and I didn't do very well either. And about that time, shortly after, he got drafted in the service, and that kind of ended that career. And then later, a couple of years later, when he got out of the service, we went to the races and saw, you know, the same jalopy races, and we got a little better financial position. Not that we had enough money really to run a good race car, but we built another car and went out, and I had just enough experience from the time before that I thought I ought to win every race. And after wrecking my car week after week, finally I realized that, or somebody realized that I had all this desire, no talent. And I blew the engine up and I didn't have enough money to fix it. And he came to me and he said, I'll build an engine for your car if you just listen to me. And he said, just slow down, quit trying to win the race in the first corner. And he did, and his engine run better than mine, and it just all of a sudden started clicking, and so I started from there and started winning races.
Is it true that you were given the nickname Parnelli by your friend?
Yeah, my buddy used to call me poor Nellie all the time, and the reason that he did was there was a girl in school, her name was Nellie, and he kidded me about her all the time, and so he called me poor Nellie, because actually I went to school under the name Rufus, and then when I first started racing, I was only 17, so I had to have a phony identification, otherwise the kids would have known that I wasn't 21 years old, and he was very artistic, and he lettered my car, and also put Parnelli on it, and that's where it all started.
Were you trying to hide your racing from your parents and from friends?
Well, I was trying to hide my, the fact that I was underage.
Right.
And at that time, you had to be 21, and of course, if I had raced under Rufus, all the kids would surely known that I wasn't 21 years old, and they probably would have leaked out, and they would have kicked me out.
Did it take long before you started winning and started making some money?
Once I controlled my desire and started slowing down and I started developing my talent. I don't think I was a natural driver. I just had a lot of desire. And I think that's carried me a long way.
So you didn't fall in love with racing by watching races or watching events on television. You fell for it by having a car to go out.
We used to have a track right near us in Gardena where I started racing. And I went out to this Carroll Speedway and actually climbed over the fence and saw a track roadsters and sprint cars running. And this one guy in the back was stuck out of the car quite a ways, and he was a big guy and started in the back, and he won the race, and he made a great impression on me, and his name was Troy Ruttman, who also won Indianapolis in 1952 with J.C. Agajanian.
Was Troy Ruttman then your first mentor, so to speak, or your first racing hero?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Did you have a favorite form of racing when you were coming up? I mean, were you looking at stock cars or the Indy cars or dirt tracks or?
No, I don't think I had any favorite cars at all. I mean, I just started out in the old jalopies, and that's all I knew. And then after I started being pretty dominant, winning a lot of races, then people started saying, "Boy, you need to go somewhere. You need to keep going up the ladder or something, so to speak." So I went to a NASCAR modified race one night, and I was watching another guy, and one of the other guys was driving jalopies. He came up in the stands, and he asked me if I wanted to drive the car. And I said, "Sure, I'd love to." And so he said, "Well, let me go talk to the owner." So he went back down and talked to the owner, and so I borrowed his helmet and everything else and went out and won the main event.
That's a great story.
I owned that ride, and it seemed like everything I stepped up into, I was fortunate to win. And I think a lot of that was, we used to have as many as 200 cars. Not that we had 200 cars every week, but we had probably close to 100 cars every week in the jalopy races. And they only took 16 for the main event. And as I remember, I went most of the time in the main event. You had to push, shove, and bang and everything else and booger as much in cars as you could to gain any position. Well, when I went into other types of racing, I didn't have 100 cars to race. I only had 30 or 40 cars to race. And it seemed like the competition was not as keen as it was in the jockeys.
Interesting. But yet you don't think you had natural talent for racing.
Well, I don't think I was. I think I learned to have great car control, but I don't know that I was a natural race driver. Yeah, I think if anything that I came natural to me was road racing. You know, I was able to turn both directions, and it's like a duck to water, really.
What is it that makes one driver better than another, aside from the car?
Well, I think more than anything is desire. I think it's that will to win. I mean, talent, car control, guys that have great car control and have a lot of desire. I mean, I think one of the guys that has the most desire in racing that happened to be A.J. Foyt. I mean, he had tremendous storage desire, and the fact that he was from Texas gave him about a 10% more. But he had a lot of desire and a good race driver at that.
Parnelli Jones comes to Indianapolis and waits no time racing to the head of the pack when one-on-one continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith, and today's guest is former Indy 500 winner, Parnelli Jones. Parnelli built his racing career from the ground up, and by the time he got to the Speedway in 1961, he was ready to run with the big boys. Here's Parnelli on becoming an overnight sensation in the biggest race of them all. Well, you first come to Indianapolis in 1961. You're hooked up with J.C. Agajanian. You are the Rookie of the Year at the 500. You and Bobby Marshman.
Yeah.
And I've read that in that race, you were hit by some debris and your goggles filled with blood, and you had a difficult time finishing that race.
Yeah, I actually was leading the race, and one of the cars we were lapping or something threw up something and nailed me in the left eye, just, well, actually below my eye a little bit, and I guess it was in the eyebrow. But anyway, it kind of filled my goggles up full of blood for a while. Finally, it quit, but shortly after there, my car lost a cylinder. I had to come into pits and, you know, put in a new spark plug and go back out.
Then in 1962, you're the first driver ever to qualify over 150 miles per hour, and you're the pole sitter. I mean, you have almost instant success there. Did it seem that easy to you because of all your experience prior to that?
Well, I think so. I mean, Speedway was very good to me, and some tracks you take to very well, and that happened to be one of mine. And in 1962, out of any race that I should have won, would have been that one. Mm-hmm. I was long gone and lost the brakes, and and wound up making two pit stops with no brakes and no brains either. But but anyway, that race I really felt bad about winning. I could have won that race four or five times. Mm-hmm. Had I been lucky.
Oh, I know. Well, you started in the top six every year, and you led five of the seven races you competed in. So, and you were second in the other two. So, yeah, you were had a chance to win every race. I read that in that 1962 race, you almost lost the car coming out of turn four, and you made a move to save the car, and that move kind of taught you something about how to come out of the turns.
Well, it was actually 1961, my rookie year. If you remember, before that, Jack Turner flipped it down the front straightaway, and that's basically what he did. But watching the films from Jim Herdeby's qualifying the year before I got there in 1960, he was actually sliding the car a little bit through the corners, and I didn't notice too much about it other than watching the film. And then in 1961, when I would come off of turn four, I got the car sideways and almost crashed and almost did a Jack Turner thing, almost hit the wall on the outside. And if I'd have hit the wall, it would have probably flipped down the front straightaway like Jack's did. But it didn't, and I just saved it. And I knew then, right then, if it ever did that again, I'd be ahead of it. So that taught me that, you know, that can happen very easily. And so anyway, I didn't think too much about it then. And then looking at the film that Herdeby's did the year before and seeing, basically, I started learning to slide the car a little bit.
Yeah.
I got it all from that first instant.
Well, what's it like to finish a race with no brakes, as you did in 1962?
Yeah, well, like I said, no brains. You know, what happened, I was leading the race, and I just drove the thing until a cord was in the tires and figured I can, you know, because I was getting $150 a lap, figured I might as well stay out here as long as I could. And so I stayed, and I slowed down, and so I came in the pits, and as soon as I went across the start-finish line, I figured, okay, that's it. And I coasted around the track, and I came in, and when I did, they hit the air jacks and wham, put three tires on the thing and shoved me out before I could tell them, I don't know if I want to run anymore. And I thought, well, gee, maybe I should go out and analyze what, before I give up the race and analyze what's happening, because you don't use the brakes that much in the race, so. I did, and I just stayed out and stayed out of everybody's way. And next time I had to make a pit stop, I tried a little bit harder to come in, and so I was running a little too fast, and I got them pits, and I rubbed it up against the wall and ran over my tires they had laid out. And they grabbed the car and pulled it back and put another set of tires on, and I think I finished...
Finished seventh.
Seventh, wasn't it?
Yes, finished seventh. But then in 1963, you are both the pole sitter and the winner of the race, and that race was notable for the first appearance of the rear engine cars, right? The Lotus Fords?
Well, they made one pit stop, and I made three.
So that ought to tell you something. You know, of course, toward the end of the race, my car was leaking some oil.
Right.
They were contemplating on black flagging me, and of course, I didn't have any idea they were. The oil that was coming out of it came onto my left rear tire. If anybody was bothering anybody, it was bothering me. And then it quit. It quit leaking, and I run next to the last lap of the race. I run one of the quickest laps to run all day long. But it was oily all day. I mean, it was two or three cars that they pulled out of the race that was really dumping oil.
J.C. Agajanian had to argue with Harlan Fengler that the oil had dropped below the crack that was causing the leak.
Right.
And therefore, there would be no more leaks.
Well, it quit. You know, when it first broke, when the thing cracked, all that oil comes spewing out on my left rear tire, and I darn near spun it. But, I'd slowed down and everything else, and pretty soon it quit. And by that time, you know, I was about running my way. The only time it leaked at all was when I backed off at the end of the straightaway, and then a little puff of smoke could come out of it because the oil that was coming out was hitting the exhaust header.
But the Lotus owner, Colin Chapman, was arguing that you needed to be black flagged.
He was trying to get us to black flagged. And his car owner, I mean, he was Jimmy Clark's car owner. And of course, JC was my car owner, and he was trying to argue in my behalf.
But there was, I know you had a bit of a confrontation with your friend Eddie Sachs, right, the next day?
Yeah, because poor Eddie, I mean, Eddie was a great, great race driver and had a tremendous amount of talent. He just had no real mechanical ability, but he had spun toward the end of the race, and they pushed him off, and then on the last lap or something, he lost a wheel, and I think that he probably spun it because the wheel was loose in the first place. But anyway, he at the Autolite luncheon the next day. I met him in the hall, and he congratulated me, and he says, "But you should have been black flagged." And he says, "Because I spun in your oil." And I said, "Eddie, you didn't spin my oil. I think you spun because your wheel come loose." And he said, "No, I spun in your oil." And I said, "Look, it was oily all day long." I said, "I don't how you can say it was spoiling my oil." And he said, "Well, I did, and I spun your." And I said, "Well, I had a punch in the nose." He says, "Go ahead," so I'll let him have it.
He dared you, and you did it.
We were friends after that. And Eddie had a lot of talent, but he just had no mechanical ability.
How do you think your life would have been different if you had not won that race? I mean, if you had never won the Indianapolis 500.
Yeah, I'm sure it would have been. Winning an Indianapolis 500, opens the doors for you in many ways and also gives you, a top title, and it certainly propelled me, and there's no question about it. And I've always loved the Indianapolis Speedway, and I just like to see it come back and be as good as it always was.
In 64, you started fourth and finished 23rd. You had a fire in the pits that knocked you out of the race. And then
what happened was we did a, we were always trying to improve my roadster, and Johnny Polson, my mechanic, he was always, trying to make the best out of everything. And we built a aluminum fuel tank, and we were carrying 75 gallons of fuel at that time, and we didn't have any fuel cells or anything like that, and the aluminum tank probably was not strong enough. And so during the race, I was having a little problem. It was having a little pickup problem, and I made a little bit of an early pit stop, and when I did, they have an asbestos tube that went over the tailpipe, and the guy that pulled that asbestos tube off about the same time that they pulled the fuel nozzle out, and it dripped on the exhaust and ignited the fuel and into the tank, and then Polson slammed the tank closed, and of course it just puffed and blew it up. And I was in it, and inside the cockpit came the fuel as I was starting to pull out. And somebody down the apron stopped me, and I jumped out in front of me. And at that point in time, all that fuel come into the cockpit and was on fire. And I, of course, bailed out it, lit on my head, and didn't hurt myself. But did burn myself a little bit.
Wow.
And, of course, that was the end of the roadster days for me.
Jones dominates Indy with a legendary STP turbine in 1967, but winds up suffering his most devastating defeat, one he now blames himself for, but one-on-one continues. But first, here's Sid Collins with the call of Jones' victory in 1963, and then Jones' stunned reaction from victory lane.
And there's a checkered flag for Parnelli Jones, the winner of the 1963 500-mile race.
Well, the only thing I can say is I love everybody. I just can't believe it yet. I'm sitting here and I'm trying to tell myself that you won the race, and I just can't believe it.
We're back on One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. Keep in mind, this and all other episodes of One-on-One are available on the website at 1070thefan.com. Get yourself to the homepage, scroll to the bottom, and you'll have access to all the podcasts of this series. And now back to today's guest, Parnelli Jones, who created quite a stir in 1967 with Andy Granatelli's Turbine, but fell victim to his own urgency in a $6 part. And in 65, you start 5th and finish 2nd. And then in 66, you start 4th and finish 14th.
Yeah.
And then you decided to retire. It didn't turn out to be your last race, but you had decided to retire after that 66 race?
What happened is I had a good friend that, you know, kept saying, you're going to hurt yourself, you're going to kill yourself, blah, blah, blah. And he says, and I told him, I said, if I ever win Indy, I'll quit. And, of course, when you win Indy, you know, the doors open for you so many ways that it's pretty hard to walk away at that point. But I always had that in my mind. And in 1967, I was driving my own car. I was in partners with J.C. Agajanian. And we had a quick car. That's the one I had a wheel bearing go out at Indy. And I was leading a race at Phoenix later in that year and sat on a pole with it. Then we come back for the 67 race, and I was testing my car over at Phoenix in early 67, and Andy, who I had driven entire test, I had driven the Nova and run pretty quick with it, and from that point on, Andy was trying to get me to drive the Nova, and I would not because it didn't have a real liability track record. Anyway, so we started socializing a bit, and Andy invited me over to see the Turbine in Santa Monica, and I did, and I went over, and I didn't think it was going to work at all, and I said, bring it over to Phoenix. I'm going over there and testing in March. And I said, bring it over there and I'll take a ride in it. And he did. And the more I drove it and the more curiosity I got in it, and I thought this might be a fun deal. I had mixed emotions after I tested it over there. I wasn't all that quick, but I wasn't slow either. So anyway, I thought, I could probably take the car and make the race at Indy. You know, and so I kept saying to myself, whether I wanted to drive my car or not. So I said, money's got to be a factor. So I said to myself, would you do it for $25,000? And I answered myself and said, no. I said, would you do it for $50,000? I said, no. Would you do it for $100,000? For $100,000, I'd probably drive the car. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I told Andy I wanted $100,000. He paid me. Anyway, of course, he said I had to qualify the car, and which I did. And obviously, a lot of people didn't give the car any real credit for how well it handled. It did handle well, and it was my idea to put that air brake on there because most 70% of the braking is always on the front end of the car, and that was hooked to the back master cylinders so that when you hit the brakes, if you had to hit them hard, the rear brakes would keep the rear end down enough to slow it down in the corners in case you did lose the front brakes. Anyway, I had a lot of fun with it because I didn't have any idea it was going to be as good as it was in the race. However, in the 7 years that I ran there, my worst starting spot was 6th,
right,
starting on the outside of the second row. Anyway, during the month of May, the guys were running light loads of fuel and running a little bit of nitro, 10 or 15%, Foyt and Gurney and Mario and them guys. And they were running light loads of fuel. Well, again, this thing would run really hard coming off the corners and across the short straightaways. But about halfway down the straightaways, it would quit accelerating. And these guys would drive by me. And when they did, they thought I was backing off. And I wasn't. I had no reason to. So anyway, they started accusing me of sandbagging, and of course the press picked it up, and everybody was sending me sandbags in the mail, everything else. And I was, of course, having a good time because I figured race day that they probably put on 75 gallons of fuel. I knew how much it slowed their cars down, and took that 10 or 15% nitro they were running, probably would not be able to get back by me. And basically, that's what happened. I mean, so when the race started, I had seen Herdebees do this before. In 1963, the year I won, he was starting second alongside of me, and we came down to the start. He jumped out of gear and he put the Novi back in gear, and he went around everybody in the first turn except for me, and he caught me at the end of the back straightaway and passed me. You know, so I had that in mind that when they start the race and everybody starts coming off the wall, and I would accelerate down the outside and go through the outside of the turn. I did, and I passed everybody on the outside except for Mario. And perfect timing, I caught him in turn two just as I was coming off of turn two. Went underneath him in a half a lap, I was leading the race.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he gave me a one lap sign as I went by. But anyway, that was my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah. Wait, when you say Mario gave you the one lap sign,
yeah,
you talking about a certain finger? Just to, so we're clear.
Yeah, with the wrong finger.
The wrong finger, yeah. That's funny. And you dominated the race, but you talked about people mailing you sandbags and so forth, but were the other drivers giving you a hard time all month for driving
that
car?
They were in a joking way.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they weren't mad at me. I guess maybe they were, but I was having as much fun with it as any, because I kept saying, how fast are you guys going to run on race day? Because I want to know where to set the screw. So I was ribbing. I was screwing them too, you know. So
sure, sure.
I was playing with them, and, I figured, what the heck, I'll go do it the best I can. That's what I can do. But I do fault myself for accelerating the car out of the pits, because it had a lot of torque. Didn't have a lot of horsepower, but it had a lot of torque. And it would jump out of the corner, off the corners, but it would accelerate hard out of the pits. And that, more than anything else, hurt that car, hurt that bearing in the rear end that finally let go. I criticized myself for that. I mean, if I had just taken a little bit easier going out of the pits, we'd have won hands down.
Mm, it was a six.
We also run a couple extra laps, you know, because of the rain and stuff like that. And that probably played a little part in the two not finishing, but.
A $6 transmission bearing breaks down with 3.5 laps to go.
Yeah.
But I never heard you blame yourself for that. That's interesting. And you had led 171 of the 200 laps.
Yeah.
Can you recall your feeling when your car broke down there with 3.5 laps to go? That must have been tough.
Well, one thing that happened toward the end of the race, I mean, Foyt was right in front of me. I was ready to lap him, and he was running second. And I just stayed right there behind him, and I started really taking it easy at that point. And that's really what hurts, you know, when you do really back down and take it easy. I was just running the same speed that he was running, and it just quit. I mean, it was like taking it in, putting it in neutral, and just done. I couldn't believe what was happening. The only thing that I was thinking toward the end of that, before that happened, I was thinking winning again probably wouldn't be as great as it was the first time. But then, obviously, it was. I mean, it hurt a great deal. But anyway, it did help me make a decision that in 1968, if winning wasn't going to be all that exciting, what are you doing it for? Because my business was taken off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And I had sacrificed my early life without children, and I love kids, and kind of changed my whole life after the 67 race.
Ah, okay. Well, in 68... you know, you were going to race. I mean,
tested
the car.
The Turbine, you know, what happened is Andy wanted me to drive the new car, or the wanted me to drive the old car.
Right.
And he had a new car there for me to with the wedge-shaped car. And I, of course, knew the wedge-shaped car was quicker than the old one. And I didn't want to get into that mess. But at the same time, I didn't feel that new car was all that safe. I mean, I'm not an educated engineer, but I was more or less a practical engineer, and I did all my chassis setups and stuff like that on my own, and I seen things in that car that I didn't think were safe. So Joe Leonard happened to be our driver, so it all kind of came together. It says, what are you doing it for? And I told Joe Leonard, who was our driver, I said, if I never won a race, you couldn't keep me out of that car. But he, of course, went out in the old car, which Andy was trying to make him do, and he crashed it. And then he got into the new car, and I did all the chassis setups on it, and we sat on the pole. with Joe, and Joe led the race and with about 12 laps to go or something like that, and Andy made a deal with Standard Oil to run gasoline instead of jet fuel, and the gasoline didn't have enough lubricant in it and froze up the fuel pump drive on the yellow flag. So when it went to take off, when they dropped the green, it wouldn't take off. And we might have gotten beat anyway. Bobby Unser, the offie had a little more straightaway speed than we did, and he might have been able to get by us, and because that car really handled well, and it was also four-wheel drive and got through the corners quick and crossed the short straightaways. But like I said, again, down at the end of the straightaway, wasn't all that quick.
Well, you're only 34 years old at this time when you basically retire from the Speedway. Did you ever, after 1968, did you ever come close to coming back and racing again?
Well, yeah, in 69, no, in 69, yeah, when we, Val and I, went and put together the team with Al Unser, and we bought the team, bought the, their garage and everything else. And what happened, I had driven for George before, McNaughty, and I always said, you know, if I was going to drive, and he's the guy I want. So we wound up going and putting together a team with Al Unser and George McNaughty and created that car. And then Al and I were out in the infield riding motorcycles, and he went to one of the drain ditches out there, and he come up out of there, and the bike fell over on him, and the peg or something on it gave him a compound fracture, and so he couldn't drive. But I came close to getting back in at that point. But I figured if you do, he'll still be there. My desire, I guess, helped me not get back in the car.
Interesting, because yeah, you only raced in the 500 seven times and had great success. How difficult was it to walk away from it?
Well, it was heartbreaking. I mean, you know, I wanted to get out of there. I mean, I didn't even want to stick around, but I did. But it was painful. Seeing everybody running and you knowing you could do that, and we had a good car. Anyway, we wound up putting Bud Tinglestad in the car, but it fell out during the race. But we came back with a car similar to that, with a few modifications, and came back the next year and won, in 70 and 71 with our cars. We dominated the 70 race. I think we led 191 of the 200 laps or something like that.
But you did do off-road racing in the 1970s.
I got dared into that. I mean, Bill Stropp, I won the stock car championship for Bill Stropp and USAC when USAC had as big a stock car racing organization as NASCAR. Won the championship in 64, and then Bill was always started hounding me to drive one of them off-road vehicles, them Broncos, and I kept saying, no, I don't think it's my bag, and everything else. And he knew how to get to me, and he said, well, you're probably not man enough.
Oh.
That was like throwing the red flag. And I said, well, you get that thing ready. And, of course, he was right. I mean, he put another guy in with me, and I told the guy, I said, well, if you think I'm running too fast, I says, tap me on the knee. And the guy about beat me to death. Anyway, I tore the thing up. I mean, run the front wheels, just run the tires off the front wheels, and couldn't make it to the first pit stop, actually. But I seen that there was such a recreational fun about it that I decided I wanted to do it again. So that started that.
Jones reminisces on his racing career and ruminates on his business career when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. Parnelli Jones got out of racing with life and limbs intact, but didn't stop competing. Despite no formal education in business, his career outside of racing took off as the driving career ended. Here's Parnelli reflecting on his life inside and outside the cockpit. I'm curious, you lost some of your closer friends in the 1960s to racing fatalities, Bobby Marshman, Jim Herdebees, Eddie Sachs. Did those occurrences have any impact on your decision to quit when you did?
Well, I was two-time national sprint car champion and Midwest sprint car champion before that. And we used to run them high bank racetracks, and they were very dangerous. I mean, in our type of racing back then, we were losing a driver or two a year, And you have to look in the mirror and realize that this is a dangerous sport. I think it's a lot safer today with the equipment that we have, but then a lot of that goes through your mind. I always felt that I relied on my own talent. I knock on wood, I've been very fortunate not getting hurt. Probably the worst I ever got hurt when I got burnt jumping out of the car in 1964. But really something to say. All the times I run sprint cars and stuff, I never was upside down.
Yeah, that is impressive.
Midgets, I can't say that. I was upside down twice in a midget.
While you're racing, you're building a business empire. I mean, you're having great success. You told me earlier that Troy Ruttman told you to be smart with your money and invest it with the right people.
I set goals financially for myself. When I was driving for JC, he wanted to get something going, and so he helped me make down payments on some property and things like that, and kind of guaranteed me that I wouldn't lose my investment if I got hurt or something like that. And we excel like that, and the property appreciated, and so on and so on. And I basically did the same thing with Val, my partner Val, who I started. I just, wanted to better myself and make investments and things like that, which I did, and they slowly paid off. I could see that my business being my financial future, and was growing with my tire stores and my tire business, and also, we became partners with Val in the Ford dealership, that sort of thing. So,
yeah.
And then grew with that.
Do I understand correctly that at one time you owned 45 Firestone tire stores?
Actually, 47.
47?
Okay. Yeah, at one time, And we had, besides that, we had four wholesale warehouses as well. One in Phoenix and San Diego and one here.
And I know you still have business things going. What are you doing now from a business perspective?
Well, now I'm in the real estate business, which is, I got commercial real estate stuff. I do some spec stuff on building. I built about three homes that are high-end homes, and I've got one for sale right now, and not good timing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just piddle with that. Kind of semi-retired. I do a lot of charity things and play a few golf charity things and things like that.
Yeah. It seems like the 60s, though, had so much innovation. Maybe the most colorful decade. You had the rear engine cars come in. You had the Novi. You had the turbines. I mean, do you see it that way? Do you look back on that decade with the most fondness? I mean, obviously, that's when you competed. But do you think the 60s was the best time for the race?
Well, I think, I always say we raced in the best of times. And today, it's too, I think electronics and hurt racing a lot. They put so much emphasis into the car and taking the talent away from the driver. Not that we don't, have a lot of talented race driver. They just put it, there's so much to do with the equipment anymore. I mean, we used to think it, the cars were, it was a 50-50 deal. I mean, driver was 50% of the car's performance. And today, I'd say that number's, 80%. Car.
Is there any way to put the driver back into the equation?
There are ways. I mean, that's the thing that we need to, I hope we do some of the right things in the right direction to make Indianapolis, it'll never probably come back like it was, but we need Ford and Chevrolet there fighting each other, and I'm really a strong fan of the American-made cars, and even though Japanese cars are great and all that stuff, there's no question about it, and they're welcome to come and run, but we also need our cars running there as well, just like we do in NASCAR.
Yeah, it seems like there's got to be a way to bring back innovation like you had in the 1960s. I mean, now all the cars are the same.
I don't know if we can ever do it at exactly like that, but I think we can certainly open the doors and bring the American cars back. And then if, you need the numbers. If you get the American cars coming back to Indy, and you'll certainly develop the numbers, and that's what we need. We need some of the numbers. We need some of the get some more American drivers in there as well.
Do you feel like the drivers had more fun when you raced than the drivers do now?
Yeah, but Payne has no memory.
Payne has no memory.
I know we did. I mean, I know we enjoyed and we had a lot of camaraderie together, and we used to have, after the races at DeCoin and Springfield and different places, We had big corn feeds, you know, where they boil corn and big gobs of butter and all that stuff. And we'd right after the race, we all got along great. I mean, you know, we had our little ups and downs during the race occasionally, but we got along pretty well. And I think we respected. I think we lived in, because it was so more dangerous then, I think we maybe had a little more respect for each other.
Well, I know you're coming back again for the race this year. How long will you be here? Will you stay for the race, or?
Well, I'm coming back for the first weekend of qualifying. Actually, we have a theme there on the 19th for our fundraiser for Sam Smith, and I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to be there for the weekend of qualifying, and then I'm coming home, and it depends on when I come back or what time, whatever.
I know you're going to miss the Speedway Motel, because from what I hear, you used to, you know, you guys would gather there and leave the doors open and congregate and, you know, walk into each other's rooms. I mean, it's going to seem different, isn't it, without the motel?
Oh, no question about it. Well, it was last year. I mean, it was a total shock when they tore down the hotel. I mean, and, you know, they didn't give us a lot of notice or anything like that. I think we could have done a better job, you know, because we're all family there. You know, you go year after year and everybody's got the same room and walk down, half the doors were open and your friends were there, and the golf course right there, you could bring your golf clubs out of the room and go out and play, and you had closed circuit television in the room so you could find out what's going on at the track. So if you wanted to go over there, fine. If you didn't, that's fine. So you know, it was all taken away from you like that, and that was a total shock to me.
How was it, you know, you've been so successful in business, and you explained how, you know, you invested in everything, but did your childhood influence that? I mean, I don't know how poor you were growing up, yeah. But did that influence that?
Oh, yeah, no question about it. When I grew up, I mean, I had clean clothes, but my parents were fairly poor, and not that they were really poor, but other kids had things that I didn't have, and I used to think one of these days, you know, blah, blah, you know.
Yeah.
That was my determination, I guess. In business, you know, I've been fortunate to surround myself with good people like J.C. Agajanian, who helped me, like a father in a lot of ways, and also Bell Militich, who we lost with my partner, and, you know, I miss those guys, but, you know, Bell was more the business side, and I was probably more the racing side of it. But in a lot of ways, you know, if you make good partners, sometimes it really helps, because you get a chance to say, well, let me run across my partner, and you get a chance to think about it a bit. We made good decisions, made some good investments, and that's, you know, that's what counts. Firestone helped me a great deal, you know, in my early days, and when they gave me the race tire distributorship, we distributed all the racing tires in the 11 western states, and
mm-hmm.
obviously started selling passenger tires, and that's what excelled the thing, and built the first store, and it was a booming success, and built the second one, third one, fourth one, fifth one, so on and so forth. We grew with it. I mean, it wasn't like we went out and opened 47 stores.
Yeah. Did you find you had a natural aptitude for business? Because, you know, you didn't have business education. You didn't go to college, right?
Probably not. I mean, I knew that you had to surround yourself with the best people. If you surrounded yourself with the good people, I mean, just like drivers and crews and mechanics and stuff like that, you know, if you get the best, you're going to be the best.
More with Parnelli Jones when One-on-One continues.
Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. Man, Parnelli Jones came and went, didn't he? Just 7 races at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, but he left an impression that'll last forever. Rookie of the Year, 2 poles and a victory. He led in 5 of his races and was running 2nd in the other 2. Ask the veteran drivers and historians around the Speedway, and his name always comes up as one of the greatest ever to grace the Speedway's asphalt. And while it would have been nice if he competed longer, give him credit for getting out when he felt the time had come. He won in every kind of car he competed, from jalopies to sprint cars to Indy cars to stock cars, and I count 6 racing halls of fame that have admitted him. He's now the 2nd oldest surviving winner of the 500, second only to 1960 champion Jim Rathman. Rathman's not in good health, but as you can tell, Jones is still going strong. Today's theme song, by the way, is called Proud and Humble by the great Imelda May. It fits Parnelli because he was proud enough to pop Eddie Sachs in the nose when his victory in 1963 was questioned, but humble enough to give up his racing career when the time was right. A lot of other drivers have stayed in the game too long because of their ego, but Parnelli knew when to leave. Next week on One-on-One, I'll be back with another conversation with a racing legend, right here on 1070 The Fan.